welcome back to Regarding Your Money Chestnut Investment Attitudes. I am George Toth, and with me on the line is Dr. Peter Morici, and want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day, Doctor, and being with us on the Newsmaker line. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what happened last year? What were the significant, what were the important, what were the consequential events of last year economically?
Well, fundamentally, we avoided a recession. So many naysayers believed that the effects of the tax cut would wear off and that the U.S. economy would slip into recession. And in reality, consumers have gone forward at a fairly steady pace. They never really reached the level of irrational exuberance in their behavior, so to speak. And so that was good. On the negative side, the investment boom never materialized. Part of that may have been the China trade business, but in reality, I think it's just changes in the nature of how businesses invest these days. They don't buy a lot, as much equipment as they used to. Instead, they're investing in intellectual property, and that doesn't show up in the investment figures in the GDP account. It shows up in other places. There was also, at the end of the year, the House, you know, passed the trade deal with Mexico, and in the Senate in the beginning of 2020, confirm that, so that's done. And Mr. Trump announced a phase one trade deal with China, which was signed January 15th. Both of those should give us some lift as we move through 2020. So that those are good things that, that happened. And you know, this looks to be a year on a more solid foundation, but for two things, and things do come up. I mean,
sure,
that you can't foresee that aren't a function of policy, and that's Boeing and its closure of the 737 MAX line, which has wide repercussions through the middle of the country and on the West Coast, and the situation now emerging in China with the virus and the epidemic there.
A couple things I want to pick up, threads that you I want to maybe pull in a little bit. You mentioned that their investment boom wasn't as maybe as rosy as you had hoped. So CapEx is not happening. What's manufacturing has been slowing down since the 50s and hiring along with that. We know that. Effectively, are we in a different phase, the manufacturing cycle, or not the cycle, but the manufacturing culture of this country, or in a new phase?
The storyline is changing. We're still manufacturing a great deal, and until the Boeing shutdown, we added jobs 31 out of 33 months. So we were added employees.
Yeah.
You know, the 31 out of 33 of Trump's months, we added employees. If you adjust for the GM strike, and but now we have this situation with Boeing, and we don't know how much of the job losses in December and likely January were Boeing, but they're there because it spreads through the supply chain. It doesn't necessarily happen in Seattle. But the thing about manufacturing these days, let's look at General Motors. They're not producing any more cars. They're producing higher value cars, or vehicles, really, because they're producing SUVs. And a lot of that has to do with all the intellectual property, the software they pump into them. When they write their own software, it doesn't show up in the GDP accounts as expenditures on capital equipment. It shows up as expenditures on employees. So it comes at you in a very different way. And they're not adding plants to increase the capacity of cars they make, but rather they're going to make more sophisticated cars. They're going to make electric cars. Another thing that's happening is that products are getting simpler because of electronics and therefore require fewer hands to make. You know, the electric car is the most profound contemporary example. It requires about 35% of the labor of a regular car to assemble because there's so many fewer moving parts. But this has been going on a long time. When we were kids, you know, when I was a kid, vending machines, you put a dime in and then you'd have like lots of different selections. And you'd push the button and you'd hear a lot of clicking going on. Well, that clicking in the back were relays and switches. You know, basically old-fashioned electromechanical devices that went through an algorithm to give you what you wanted, you know, coffee with two creams, with no sugar, whatever. Today, that's all electronic. If you open up a vending machine a few generations ago, there's all kinds of copper wiring in it and switches today. It's just a circuit board.
Yeah.
It's a very, very different contraption.
Okay.
It does the same thing, but it does it with a lot less capital equipment.
Yeah. So let's.
That's one of the reasons that go down to the Best Buy and try to buy a TV set that's 19 inches, and it's a couple of $100. Well, you know, my first TV set when we got married 50 years ago was a black and white TV that cost $200.
Yep. There you go. Let me ask.
Right.
Yeah, let me. I think I point well taken, but let me ask you about something that's equally as important as the Boeing is this USMCA. Compare and contrast. There you go, Professor. Compare and contrast that to NAFTA for us.
So is this the exam question for the PhD in international economics?
Yeah.
The salient elements that are different. When we did the NAFTA, we didn't have the internet, and we didn't have this technology that we have today, and it wasn't covered. We were primarily focused on manufacturing and financial and professional services, banking, accountants, things like that. Well, the whole area of technology has now been written into the agreement. The TPP would have done that with the Pacific countries if we had gone through with that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is it creates tougher content requirements with regard to stuff that has to be made someplace in one of the three countries to be included in the deal in terms of cars. The local content requirement is much higher. So if we're going to import steel inside the car from Mexico, then it has to be Mexican steel. It can't be Chinese steel. And the old agreement did have significant rules of origins in it and content requirements in areas like textiles and petrochemicals. This basically beefs them up in automobiles. And then there's this attempt to intervene in Mexican labor markets, which may prove to be not particularly operative because it's very, very difficult to tell people how to run their own judicial system, especially when the people who are seeking rights are not American nationals, but Mexican nationals. So, but I have to say this, you know, Mexico has not been a particularly backward place when it comes to labor rights. I think this was more of a show thing for the labor movement so they'll go along.
Okay.
The labor movement got a lot of what it wanted in this deal without those labor requirements. But politics being what it is, it has to object. So this is the way, this is kind of a kabuki dance.
Well, so if you were to design USMCA, what would you add and subtract?
Well, I think I'd just leave it alone. I mean, I wish the content requirements weren't necessary, but that's more a function of our problems with China, and the Mexico doesn't have the same defensive mechanism.
Yep.
With regard to the labor requirements, I don't think they're necessary, but I don't think it hurts that they're there.
Okay.
So, you know, leave it at that.
Okay.
I think the agreement's fine, more or less.
Okay.
I mean,
all right.
You know, you're asking me, what would you do about three volumes each the size of, you know, the telephone book.
Got it. And that's, of course, the thing of the past. You mentioned something in your introduction that you were concerned or at least noticing the effect of the tax cut might wear off. My sense for it is that the ripple effects of the tax cut are going to be still coming towards us or rippling out, whichever image metaphor you would like to use. Am I wrong in that assumption, or is that...
I said there was concern about that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as though the tax cut consequences are longer lived for consumers than was anticipated, just as they weren't as big as they were anticipated to be with regard to investment.
Mm-hmm.
In 2020, the economy would be in good shape, but for Boeing and the virus in China, both of which, you know, those are like almost like natural events.
Yeah.
And certainly not something that emanated from Washington. Or from Wall Street, and we just have to see how we weather those. It is very early in the process of this virus to see its true consequences.
Right.
Whether it's isolated simply in China or whether it overflows into the U.S. economy.
Right.
It certainly is going to be felt in Asia because of Chinese tourism and so forth.
Yeah.
But it remains to be seen. The Boeing thing, I'd like to know when they're really going to stop making planes over there.
Yeah.
The date game's getting pushed out, and what is becoming apparent is that Boeing as cultural problems, much in the way General Motors did prior to the restructuring of General Motors. Maybe it wasn't a culture in General Motors that was, you know, cavalier about safety, but it was cavalier about quality generally.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the people in Chicago don't take the making of airplanes from a safety perspective very, very seriously.
Yeah.
Basic rules, the very first principles were violated in the design and certification of that plane.
Mm.
And frankly, I would be all for a criminal investigation, but for the fact that that would be bad for the country.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
Well, think about it.
Yeah.
After the first crash, they knew they had a real problem. They let the second crash happen. What is the definition of criminal negligence?
Mm-hmm.
Now, somebody inside that company made that decision.
Wow.
I'd like to know who he is and have him brought to justice.
Wow.
People died because of that negligence.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Well, that will affect the GDP in your estimation, along with the virus.
Really too early to get a handle on that because we don't know how far the ripple effects will be outside the Chinese economy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, clearly shutting down cities as they're doing as we speak, locking them down, is going to have consequences within China. But the question is, how much real consequence does that have over here?
Yep.
We need to know more yet.
Let me shift a little bit with you. You mentioned in an interview that I caught on the air on another network about your concern for income inequality. I would posit that income inequality was much worse under the previous administration than this one because of rising employment and, in fact, more jobs than there are workers who want those jobs. I think the inequality that's going on, while certainly apparent, and you're making more money than I am, and I'm making more money than some other people are. So income inequality is almost a fact. It is not a problem, but yet it's been sort of painted as a big issue. And I'm concerned that this is becoming a ramrod and a vector that is affecting more and more of the free market capitalism, entrepreneurship, and work ethic of this country.
Well, I think it's important to get a bearing on the fact is that income equality changes glacially.
Mm.
It's a gradual phenomenon. And if it's better now than it was 3 years ago, you know, it's less acute, it's mm-hmm. only glacially so. I mean, the direction of change with Mr. Trump has been positive in that there have been more gains for people at the bottom because the labor market's very, very tight.
Yes.
But the secular trend going back to, say, Clinton's time or even Reagan's time, you know, has been negative. From the point of view of income equality becoming larger. Now, income inequality is inevitable and necessary in a market economy and in any economy that where you want people to make personal sacrifices to improve themselves when they're young. So they become physicists and economists and lawyers and physicians and so forth. Not everybody chooses to do something that only requires, say, a high school education.
Yeah.
So you're going to have a certain amount of income inequality. The question is, at what point is it more than it is necessary? We are probably at the point where income inequality is acute enough that it is negatively affecting growth because it is making it difficult for young people to get the resources they need to go into the things that would be useful. Now, that doesn't mean that the recommendations for solving it, which are palliative, you know, give people money, Medicare for everybody are solutions.
No, they're not.
Also, some of this is not just the income people have, but the prices at which they have to buy at. Incomes in 2019 were at about the same level as they were in 1999. There's been no basic change in after-inflation income. However, the things that people consider most important have gone up more than the rate of inflation, while things that people consider less important have gone up much less. The big inflation areas have been things like higher education,
yes,
housing, and so forth.
Medicine.
And Medicare. Medicine and child care.
Yeah.
Those things have two fundamental consequences. Fewer people having fewer children, a lower fertility rate, that impedes growth. The children that we have having fewer opportunities.
Mm.
If you're born into the top 25%, you've got great opportunities from the point of view of your parents having the financial resources to educate you. If you're born in the lower 50%, it's very hard, especially if you're not near one of the big metropoles of technology. Just simply, the local colleges don't have what you need. That's a real problem. In many, many counties in America really are in what I call education deserts, in the sense that you can get some kind of diploma, but you can't get one that's very sellable in Chicago.
Got it.
And I think that kind of inequality is not addressed by giving people free health care or forgiving student loans.
But,
and we can talk about the merits of those things.
Yeah, but let me.
That's a separate issue.
Yeah,
you can't just throw that doesn't solve the underlying cause of the problem.
Yeah, let me interrupt for just 1 minute. I think a lot of this has to do with the atrophying of the work ethic that has been the root or the basis for this country.
I think that you're putting out a lot of Republican talking points. You know, one is that inequality was worse than the Obama years. When if it's better now, it isn't dramatically better, because the income inequality is something that moves very slowly, and once it starts getting worse, it's hard to reverse. And we've only had a few years where things have started to get better now,
mm-hmm.
so we don't know that it's really going through a process.
Income inequality.
Hold on a minute.
Okay.
The second thing is the work ethic issue is a problem, and again, these palliatives that people want to give us, you know, more social programs, more entitlements, don't encourage people to work.
That's right. That's right.
However, in many parts of the country where we have, for example, the opioid crisis being the worst and so forth, the epidemic being the worst, there aren't a lot of opportunities for young people to improve themselves. And families have to go through Herculean efforts to get their children into environments where they could improve themselves.
Hmm.
You know, going to the local state college in many parts of the country consists of getting a general degree, which doesn't do you a lot of good, especially considering that the faculty is often hawking, you know, liberal ideology and social justice, as opposed to, say, learning how to be an accountant.
Right.
But not everybody can be an accountant. All these places are good at training accountants. But, you know, a software engineer, it's hard to get that kind of training in a lot of counties in the United States, or a lot of the other interesting things there are to do in the new economy. And that is really, really problematic. Now, there are options that are being created, but I don't know that the schools, and I say that, I mean the high schools, are making young people fully aware of them. The administration, and again, this is something that continuing from the Obama years, but being more aggressive about it. The Department of Labor certifies private sector apprenticeship programs, which pay about $15 an hour,
around
1 to 2 years, and land you in pretty decent jobs. But everybody wants their kids to go to college. Well, guess what? About half the people that go to college don't get their money back.
Right.
Whereas most everybody that goes to one of these apprenticeship programs and finishes does get their money back and is better off than that 50% that went to college and didn't get their money back. So,
yeah, I think the answer.
Some of this is work ethic.
Yeah.
Some of it also is nobody wants their kids to be the ones that don't go to college, and a lot of young people are not geographically well situated. It's very, very, very difficult now in that regard. The expanse of America, the size of the country, makes it difficult.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to end on one question. How do we tamp back this horrible rise of love of and endearment of socialism over capitalism? Any final thoughts there?
We have to make the system work better for young people by giving them more opportunities. A lot of them have done what the system says. They've gone to college, they've borrowed money, ended up terribly in debt, and in lousy jobs. In a situation like that, no surprise, they're cynical. They don't get married, they don't have kids.
Yeah.
And they embrace status solutions. Trying to convince them that the market works on their behalf. Remember, people don't embrace market capitalism out of a religious impulse. They embrace it because they think it works best.
And it pays back to them.
How well something works, though, is how well it works for them.
Yep.
For you.
Yep.
And if it's not working for a person, it's not working.
Yeah, sadly, Doctor, the situation is that larger government and more government regulation and more government intervention is not going to solve this problem, in my opinion.
Well, you're going to have more government involved. The question is, what does it look like? Because the government more or less runs the education system. So, again, that's another good Republican talking point. And I'm a good conservative. You know how I align politically.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, the line that comes out of the right quarter of the Congress, and not just the fringe, but the right quarter on the Republican side, is just as unconstructive as what comes out of AOC's mouth.
Mm.
Neither of them are offering real solutions. Telling people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and work harder may be good advice, but it's not advice that works very well if you're in a situation where there's just no opportunity.
Okay. Doctor, thank you so much. And for those of you who are inclined, please visit him at T. Morici, M-O-R-I-C-I, number one, and respond at Twitter. That is his Twitter handle. Thank you very much, Doctor, for being with us here on the Newsmaker Line, and I'll talk to you again as soon as possible.